I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 8, The Lead and How to Swing It.
Dear Matt, many years ago, my first boss at Newsweek gave me some advice I've never forgotten. He told me, and I'm quoting here, "Never write anything down." I remember even at the time thinking this was strange wisdom for an editor to pass on to a fledgling reporter, but the context must have been such that it made a little bit of sense. I say must have been because what that context was, your guess is as good as mine. We might have been talking about inner office politics or the intricacies of adult dating. He'd been married a couple of times, and I was only just starting to realize that there were women in the world, and he liked to think of me as his protege. Anyway, exactly what it was that inspired him to tell me this, I just don't remember. All I know is it's years later, the context has long since evaporated, and the advice is all that remains, lingering in the air like a mist. A confusing, confusing mist. Amazingly, however, "Never write anything down" is not the most baffling piece of advice I ever got about journalism. I was also told, by the same editor, always cut the first paragraph. Now, if I squint, I can make out the germ of solid thinking in this, which is, quit drawing your pretty little filigrees in the air and get to what you want to say. But still, this one is puzzling, really puzzling, because it seems to bang right up against the most sacred cow in journalism. The lead, or the opening you draft, to grab your reader's attention. Quick fun fact, by the way, lead is properly spelled L-E-D-E, to distinguish it from L-E-A-D, or lead, which in the days of physical typesetting referred to a blank line between paragraphs or a line of lead. Congratulations, you now have the ability to identify on Twitter people who came up in print journalism and like to flash its gang signs. Anyway, the lead, L-E-D-E. It's a basic article of faith in journalism that the lead is supremely important. In this script, for example, I employed a variation on the basic historical lead. Everybody's got history, right? It's an effective way in. This was just one of the classic news magazine leads, which were so adaptable and so widely used that, at Newsweek, the archetypes were, in the 1970s, collected by a writer named Dick Booth, into a document which is still passed reverentially hand-to-hand among survivors of that time and place. Booth identified 8 classic leads, including the action lead, both big picture and little picture, the historical lead and its cousin, the then and now lead, the anecdotal lead, the scene setter lead, and the general lead. The amazing thing is, even this historical artifact isn't comprehensive. I was surprised when I recently chased down an ancient photocopy that is literally coffee-stained. At least, I hope it's coffee. I was surprised to find that Booth hadn't accounted for my personal favorite, the venerable Spot is a Dog lead, which went like this. Spot has a cool wet nose. Spot likes to dig holes and chase cars. Spot sleeps 18 hours a day. Line of lead. Spot is a dog. Now, keep in mind, this was a parody. There was knowing self-mockery in the formulation. It was an insider thing, a secret handshake exchanged between peers. When put into actual practice, the Spot is a Dog lead was considerably more subtle, and in the right hands, the hands of a Peter Goldman or a Jerry Adler or a Dick Booth, it did what it set out to do. It laid out a series of facts and marshaled them toward an unassailable conclusion, in the hope that by the end, the hook was set and you'd keep reading. Writers aren't the only creative people who do this. It's true across skills, talents, and disciplines. You gotta get them in the tent. But here's a question. Is this craft or is it trickery? The answer, I think, is it's both. Craft can be wielded like a trick when it's applied to a particular end. Writers have the lead. What do performers have? I hope you're doing well where you are, whatever time of day it may be there. It's late afternoon as I write this, and the sky is beginning to take on the apocalyptic shade of orange that tells me the wind has changed, and I'm looking at the setting sun through a haze of dust that used to be old-growth trees before we all decided we had to get places in our own cars. Of course, many of us spent much of the last 2 years staying home, so you'd think the universe might have decided to give us a pass on that one. But apparently we've been so fabulously reckless as a species that we no longer get to have nice things, like evening skies that don't look like something out of a Ray Harryhausen movie. On that cheery note, I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill, we haven't started this way in a while, but it's 11 minutes past 3 in the afternoon here in Southend-on-Sea, and I'm sitting in my posh chair with a flat white on the windowsill next to me. If you look up British Tuesday afternoon on Wikipedia, there's a picture of the view through my window. Smudgy grey skies, blustery winds, the occasional bout of drizzle. Basic British branding. I like the cut the first paragraph thing, and as I write that, I realise that the first paragraph of this script was a completely unnecessary few lines about the weather, so yeah. It reminds me of Coco Chanel's advice to look at yourself in the mirror before you go out and remove one thing from your outfit. Ah, that Nazi sure did know about style. I did, in fact, know how to spell lead as I listened to NPR podcasts, in which they often use the phrase bury the lead. So I'm assuming I must at some point have realised that I got the gist of it but nothing more and Googled it. I think there's a version of the lead in a lot of art forms. The opening bit of the work that gives its audience a taste of what's coming and convinces them to stick around, like the overture in a musical. In my business, there's an old rule that you close with your best trick, but you open with your second best. I don't always quite do that, but I am for sure guilty of the old trick of, as one of my friends once put it, coming out on stage, saying hello to the audience and telling them that you're going to do something, and then, seemingly hours or maybe days later, finally doing it. That's a structure learned on the street and in front of rowdy club crowds. If you can convincingly tell them that they're going to see something good, if they're patient, then hopefully they'll stick around for it and be attentive until they get what they were promised. The difference between my version of the lead and yours, though, is that nobody reading the opening of one of your pieces would suspect that you weren't going to make good on the first paragraph's intent. They would not reasonably think that after spending a few lines talking about the Jerry Lewis telethon, you would then slowly segue into a shopping list and, ha-ha, I made you read it. But with someone like me, people are inherently suspicious. There's a fine line between showman and shyster. Especially if the thing I'm telling them that I'm going to do seems impossible, or, at the very least, unlikely. People start to wonder if there's going to be some kind of double cross, that maybe it's all a gag rather than a spectacle. So, gotta throw that second best trick in there early so that what I'm claiming will happen seems more plausible. Earn their trust. That's the game here, isn't it? And by doing so, earn their attention. And then, ideally, you don't just do what you said you were going to do, but you do something better. In the verbiage of an old vaudevillian, set them up, feed them, then give them a topper, and they're yours. You've gone from someone promising something to someone over-delivering on that promise. And I guess that's also the mission for a writer too, to make a piece about a thing, about that thing, but also about some deeper things too. Did you see how eloquently I used language there? Damn lucky I can juggle. Sometimes, though, you are the lead. I used to work a street pitch with a gentleman by the name of Dr. Stewart. He was, in his own words, a 6'6" fresh funky fellow equally at home rapping on the street or playing a cello. He was the most wonderful street performer I have ever seen. He was a tall, beautiful guy who'd wear eccentric but formal menswear, Malcolm X glasses, a bowler hat with a chess piece on the top, and a watch around his ankle. He danced, moved, lip-synced, and generally became a living cartoon. Have you seen the film The Fifth Element? He's the tall guy bouncing around behind Ruby Rod. When he did street shows, he was his own lead. He'd gather a crowd just by standing on the pitch, looking incredible, but basically doing nothing. People would gather and wait, certain that something was going to happen, that if they waited long enough, they'd be there for something special. But mostly in street performing, our version of the lead is the crowd gather. Oh, you think you word monkeys have all the good jargon? We're talking finding the flow, the slow build, the pull, creating a dense edge, the clap and cheer. If you can master all of that, then they'll probably stay for your actual act. Unless it rains. Which it is still doing out of my window. I'll talk to you soon, Matt.
Dear Matt, you see, once you start giving your opening paragraph that skeptical side eye, I'm telling you, it changes everything. Although, referring to smudgy gray skies and a persistent drizzle as basic British branding is a stylistic hill I personally would be willing to die on. I guess when we talk about the lead, or the overture, or the first trick, what we're really talking about is structure, so we should widen our aperture a bit. After all, the initial piece of business is really only half the story, because getting your audience into the tent is only half the job. You also want to send them away satisfied, so they'll be willing to pay the cost of admission again next time. So, for every first move, there's a corresponding closing move. For journalists, that closing move is the kicker, the last thought that sums up where you've been. It's the inverse of the lead. When, in the late 80s, Donald Trump docked his ridiculous mega yacht on the East River, and I got the unfortunate but inevitable draw to go down there, tour the thing, and bring back a feature about it for Newsweek, I ended it with this image of Trump, who was at the time merely a megalomaniac real estate shyster, standing on the deck while actual working people queued up below to gawk at him. "Hey, Donald!" a guy in a beat-up old car hollers, driving slowly past on the traffic-clogged FDR Drive. Trump snaps back to reality, or whatever it is he snaps back to. "That's my people," he murmurs, waving. "Amazing." One question. If they're your people, Donald, why don't you build them some decent moderate-income housing? Looking down from his big new toy at the people of New York, Donald Trump smiles and waves, and smiles and waves. I've always liked that kicker for the note of self-deluding grandeur it suggested, and the implication that, left to his own desires, Trump would just bob permanently back and forth like one of those kids' toys with a plastic bird in a top hat. But I've also tortured myself with the thought that it was all there if I'd only taken the trouble to see it. The fake, inch-deep populism, the dumb cluck inarticulacy, the incurious failure to look past his own magnificence. And if I'd only had the wit to give the guy a slight push, he might have struck his head on the way down to the water and saved us all a lot of trouble. We all punish ourselves in our own special ways, I suppose. Anyway, that's the kicker, the writerly business you do to fix your story in people's minds. Comedy writers have the button, drama writers the two-minute drill. The producer John Wells was particularly famous for this one. "Scrub that rhinoplasty, doctor. We just got a code blue. There's an ambo full of orphans inbound from a fire at a train derailment." And in your racket, performance, it's the closer, the strongest trick. You said that with people like you, audiences are inherently suspicious. I guess that's true, although parenthetically you do refer to the component bits of your act as tricks, which is a piece of nomenclature that's always puzzled me, inasmuch as you're not a magician, and the things you do are not illusions or effects, although some of them are so astounding that they almost seem like they are. But that's quibbling. Anyway, I'll take your word for it. And I have to say, one of the things I like about your act is the skillful way you exploit not only its structure, that opening and closing and all the considered steps that get you from one to the other, but also the expectation that there's a hustle coming. Show business has a grand tradition of humbug, to be sure. But a performer who can't actually deliver a recognizable payoff to go along with the hustle? Well, in the vaudeville days, they'd be handing that guy back his photos and a train ticket. Buster Keaton once said, "I always want the audience to outguess me, and then I double-cross them." This feels to me like a pretty good description of the piece you're best known for. Do I really have to call it a trick? Which you've taken some perverse pleasure in being mysterious about since our first episode last season. I'll respect that and do what you did and just direct listeners to YouTube if they want to see what I'm talking about. And I'll simply say this. There is an element of flim-flam to it that just knocks me out. Not because what you're doing is fake, but because you deliberately mess with the audience's heads a little bit on the way to doing it. I don't want to make you talk more about it than you're comfortable with, but I'd love to hear more about the thinking behind the moment where, after building to your central piece of business, you almost toss it off. And then, you top it. As somebody who's written hundreds of stories over a few decades and sweated over every lead, every kicker, and every beat in between, I can see in your act something that's been meticulously built, the way a master bartender builds a complicated cocktail in an empty glass. The thing about building a cocktail reminds me, by the way, of a very happy memory. About 10 years ago, Jennifer and I sat in the bar at the Connaught Hotel in your hometown and watched the bartender construct a 19th century cocktail called a Floradora, which involved winding a spiral trail of Luxardo syrup up the inside of a Tom Collins glass in such a way that it survived the addition of the gin. It just stayed there somehow, suspended. That expert bartender had somehow imbued a wisp of syrup with the structural integrity of steel. It was magic. You're good with your hands. Top that, fancy man. I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, you had the chance to push Trump to his possible death from his own yacht. You had the chance, just to be crystal clear, to push Donald Trump off his own stupid huge boat onto a crowd of his fans, and you decided to not do this and seal yourself into one of the most perfect real-life pieces of symbolism in history. You would have gone to jail and wrote a best-selling book, and you'd probably be out of jail by now, having claimed it was an accident, and you just slipped and grabbed onto whatever that was on his head, which came away in your hand, and accidentally you pushed him. If you had done that, this podcast would be way more popular. It's like you don't even care. Oddly, my dad had a very similar experience. In the 80s, he found himself in a local amateur theatre group. They were doing, I think, Macbeth. The play was being staged in Margaret Thatcher's parliamentary constituency, so it somehow got added to her social events diary. Long story short, my dad, who hated Thatcher with a fury that I share, found himself standing right in front of her as she greeted all the actors, while he was in costume holding a dagger. He very genuinely felt that he had missed an opportunity by not stabbing her and regretted it for years afterwards. Anyway, yeah, I call them tricks. You're right that they're not magic, but those tuxedo-clad liars aren't the only people who have usage rights to that word. Skateboarders do tricks, acrobats, yo-yo experts. And besides, there's not an easy alternative word for my brand of dexterity-based malarkey, so yeah, trick is fine. And you're right about the structure of my act being key. As I've said before, it was developed on the street where you really have to hook people with industrial-strength theatrics so that they'll move a little closer and stick around till the end. For me, the first and most important step is to show them that I'm trustworthy. And I do that in a million conscious and subconscious ways, from showing them a few opening tricks and jokes, to saying things that show that I'm aware of their reservations, to more subtle things like dressing well, having a clean iron shirt, being aware of how I'm standing, smiling, all little signifiers of someone who won't jerk you around. Signifiers that I'm using to jerk you around. If you can get them to flip that switch in their heads from, well, I don't know about this, to, okay, I'm in, then you can have the real fun and subvert all that stuff. It's flimflam, sure, but it's consensual flimflam. They're in on the gag. It's a dance. I'm leading, but we're all doing the steps. I learned from my friend and wonderful professional wrestler, sorry, we're doing wrestling again, William Regal, how to be a heel that people love. A heel in wrestling is the bad guy, and Regal was the best at being a despicable, selfish, spiteful heel. And people loved him for it. There's a moment in my act where I get the audience to insult me. They don't know they're supposed to do it until they find themselves doing it, but it works every time, and that gives me the motivation to insult them back. A couple of nights ago, I performed at a wedding. I got to this moment, manipulated them into pretending to hate me, and took the opportunity to turn to one of the grooms and say, "Your friends and family are scum." Which of course got a huge laugh because they know I don't really mean it, just as I know they didn't really want to insult me. We're all dancing together because it's fun. And as for my closer, that's the moment when they don't know the steps. I spend my whole act telling them that soon I'm going to do a cool thing. And then when I finally get to doing the cool thing, as you say, I underplay it because all this time I've been lying to them. The real closer is even better. It's a way for me to have that bulletproof structure of, if you wait long enough, you'll see this, while also being able to give them a surprise. And I guess that's all part of the thing that makes them trust me in the first place, convincing them that I'm always one step ahead of them. That it's not just that I know what I'm doing, but sometimes they might not know what I'm doing. That if you trust me, I'll surprise you and you'll like it. It's all about having that relationship with your audience, whatever kind of audience that is, that's solid enough that they'll go somewhere with you. And I've been testing that recently as I've asked them to come with me to YouTube, which some of them have and some of them haven't, which is fine. It's fine. Seriously though, if you'd pushed Trump off his boat and my dad had stabbed Margaret Thatcher, this would be a whole different podcast. Talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, okay, look, I could stand here and say that the reason I didn't push Trump off his own stupid boat and send him plummeting into the East River is that I'm not a murderer. Although, as Harold Ramis said to the army recruiter in Stripes who asked him if he was gay, I am willing to learn. In fact, the reason that I wasn't seized at that moment with a conviction to give the guy a kick in his big waisty pants is that I'm not clairvoyant. There was simply no way to know in the summer of 1988 that the fatuous balloon-headed boob I was standing next to would, in fewer than 30 years, hold in his hands the actual, no-foolin', nuclear codes. In fact, if you'd told me that, I would have recommended that you be darted with Thorazine, because that guy was the joke of the five boroughs. So please, let me stew in my own regret, but don't make it worse by implying that I somehow decided to live the rest of my life knowing I fatally betrayed the whole human race. Now, if you want to talk about nobility, let's talk about your father, who made an affirmative decision not to fillet Margaret Thatcher, who was well established as a global villain right in that moment as she stood there before him. Although, unless British community theater productions are a lot more daring than the American kind, I'm guessing he was holding a prop dagger, not a real one. And the worst he'd have been able to do would be give the old girl a severe poking, which certainly would have been uncomfortable for her, but probably not be viewed as a grand act of political resistance. And now, back to our little chat show about creativity. If anybody listening to this felt like they needed just a bit more convincing that the first move in any creative project, that come with me moment, is critical, let me point out that you managed to say, "Your friends and family are scum," to a member of a wedding party at a wedding, and get a big laugh, and then invoice them for a job well done in the full expectation that they would pay you money. How did you do that? By getting the audience on your side. We talked a little last season about the notion of trust, about signifying to your audience that they should relax into what you're doing, and this is another good example of that transaction. What I love about how it works in your case is that, as you say, you secure their trust so that you can then betray it. And the structure of your act, from opening to closer, is the mechanism you wind up to do that. As you correctly point out, this kind of betrayal would put a reporter out of business pretty quickly. But to every craft its own rules, right? My first book, as I've talked about on this podcast before, was an experiment in seeing how long I could maintain a lie. The lie being that the book was written by a disgraced advice columnist who called himself Mr. Irresponsible. I invented a whole working life for this ridiculous character, a backstory in TV and movie terms, to prop up the notion that what readers were reading was real. It was detailed. It described where he lived, how he spent his time, who he associated with, and the circumstances under which he came to be disgraced, which involved, in a carefully thought-out order, a large quantity of industrial-grade neurotoxins, an underaged research assistant who was also a notary public, ferrets, and a cache of automatic weapons sold to him on eBay as, quote, a holiday grab bag. All an elaborate lie. This is an extreme example of the kind of thing that would end a reporter's career. It has ended reporters' careers. But in this case, I was functioning more as a writer of fiction. What passed between me and my readers in this case was close to that mutual dance of consensual flimflam you described. It wouldn't have worked, it would have collapsed, if the audience and I didn't share that initial transaction of trust. It has to be there in every kind of creative work. In the case of Mr. Irresponsible, I didn't go to the trouble of elaborately explicating his legend because I thought anybody would believe it was true, although, astonishingly, some people did, which left me flummoxed. I did it as a way of setting this character in a world that was more or less recognizable as a version of our own, because that's what would give readers the permission to join me in the lie. In the old comedy writing maxim, if they buy the premise, they'll buy the bit. That's the game. That's why the first step matters. I hope your first step is holding up, and I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill, they gave Trump the nuclear launch codes? As if. No. He got given an official NBC The Apprentice lunchbox, which, if he had ever worked out how to open it, he would have learned contained a single Twinkie. And then he would have forgot about wanting to launch missiles, distracted by the Twinkie. As for my dad, the dagger was real. Forged it himself in the shed out of aluminium, or, as you Americans say it, wrongly. I had a strange childhood on so many levels. Also, thanks for reminding me to invoice the wedding gig. I had genuinely forgotten. This whole dance we're talking about, this mostly unspoken agreement of trust between maker and consumer, between artist and audience, it reminds me of the idea of the honest magician. It's a strange kind of paradox that an art form, magic, based at its heart incontestably on lying, is somehow more honest than everything else. The point of magic is to mislead, to distract, to be dishonest, but everyone knows that. People don't see a great close-up worker at the Magic Castle and come out saying, "Holy crap, that woman could manipulate the fabric of space and time. She has somehow harnessed the power to read minds. She made my wedding ring slip through some kind of trans-dimensional portal and end up inside a lemon. Thank God she chooses to only use her powers to entertain small groups around a table in a bar and not to rule the universe." No. Magic is fun and clever and entertaining because the audience know that misdirection and dishonesty are taking place, but trust the magician that they're employing these tactics to entertain. It's illusion. The very word tells you about the wool being pulled over your eyes. The honest magician tells you that they're going to lie to you, and then does so, and you still miss it. It's almost like magic needs to make sure you know that it's not real, so that it's fun and clever. If you thought it was real, it would be terrifying. All art is some kind of magic trick, but magic is the only art that speaks that truth so blatantly. Nobody needs to be told that the actor on stage isn't Macbeth. Nobody thinks he's lying about that. Dali didn't title his painting, "Okay, so guys, the watch wasn't really melting, it's just like for fun." The audience for pretty much anything go through stages of encountering something, deciding how they'll feel about it, and then, if they like it, agreeing to the point at which they trust it in order to be rewarded. And not all of them will. Everybody doesn't like everything. Everybody doesn't get everything. Everything isn't always for everyone. If you're the person that says, but wait a minute, if it was hot enough to melt the watch, then the hands would have burned off long ago. Well, then maybe surrealism isn't your thing, which is fine. But structure is the skeleton of a creative work. The lead and the kicker are opposite ends of a spine that, if it's strong enough, will hold up whatever artistic flights of fancy you want to hang on it. And I guess it's part of the artist's job to convince a section of their audience that they're a safe bet, that whatever money gets put down, the odds of a good return are in the audience's favour. And structure is a way of doing that. But it's not the main part of an artist's job. And it's easy to get too bogged down in thinking what most people might like, when your starting point should be what you like. And to be able to do that, you have to be confident that you know what you're talking about. That what you think is of worth is. And we'll be talking about that on the next episode. I'll talk to you then. Matt.
Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barole in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barole. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.